Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. It's my pleasure to be with you here this evening. We've got, looks like Kirk and JB. How are you, fellas?
Good.
I'm good.
Hey, JB.
Good. Well, we're going to start back off on Barbara Sheath, the Genesis 2-7. I've been in the process of rewriting much of Yada Yada, as I think everybody knows, I finished not too long ago, rewriting all of Observations, managed to turn two volumes of Observations into five volumes. You know, some people kid, they said, you know, I please excuse the long letter. I didn't have enough time to write a short one. You know, so you're supposed to, with more time, get to be more concise, but I haven't learned that trick yet. And Observations is now five volumes. And, of course, Coming Home is two volumes and counting. And we just finished the edit of volume one of Yada Yada, which that volume only goes through half of what was volume one of Yada Yada. But we did finish one quarter or one half of volume one, creating a new volume one. It'll be ready in about a week's time at Amazon. Jackie is doing the marvelous job of getting these books very quickly positioned so that they're ready to go. And it's not the Amazon template is not as exacting as you would like. So each time they approve the process, we end up having to make adjustments to get everything properly balanced. So we're in adjustment mode for the next week, and then it should be ready to go. But it was nice to get that out. And I'm about halfway finished with what will be volume two of Yada Yada. It is really interesting, the things that I'm finding that I just never saw before between Adam and Chawa, and trying to ascertain the reasons for their various behaviors and statements. As I was telling Kirk before the show began, how strange the names are of that Chawa gave her two boys. And we'll talk about what those names imply. And it's a real eye-opener. But it's wonderful to have an Asama, to have Yahweh's testimony, and to be able to share it. I was having lunch today with a friend of mine here on the island, and he said, you know, wouldn't it be spectacular if God were to provide us with instructions for our modern world? You know, because everything that you've been talking about at lunch happened anywhere between 3 and 6,000 years ago. Just laughed.
Still works.
I said, first of all, there's nothing in human nature that has changed. We're exactly the way we were 5,000 years ago. So all of his instructions are still pertinent. But most of his prophecies deal with today. So when you're reading what he said, he's talking about countries like the United States. He's talking about the war in Syria. He's talking about the plan to narrow Israel at the waist and to implement a two-state solution. Now, he's still talking about the people who call themselves Palestinians. And so it is, it's as fresh as tomorrow's newspaper.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the beauty of all of this. We're not going into the account of the of Adam's creation in the garden because we want to understand what happened 6,000 years ago. We're going into the garden and analyzing Yahweh's words because we want to know more about who we are, what we can do to develop a closer, more productive, and more enjoyable relationship with Yahweh. So we can learn from what God said about the creation of Adam and his relationship with him in the garden, as well as bringing Chawa into the picture and how all of that played out. We not only learn a tremendous amount that helps us better understand who God is, what he wants, what he is looking for in return, but we just develop a tremendous insight into human nature, our own nature. Now, it was interesting. I was just prior to this program, I was translating God's first conversation with Cain. Q-A-Y-N is Cain. Cain's name is means he was created to be possessed. He was created to be controlled. I'm not going to spill the beans right now and tell you controlled for what reason. We'll get there as we move through the story of Eden. But it was what I thought was just fascinating is the passage, the instruction that God gave him. Cain was having an absolute conniption fit over Yahweh, paying more attention to Hebel's, which we call Abel. It's Hebel. Hebel actually means waste of breath in Hebrew. Not a very flattering name.
No.
So created to be possessed and waste of breath with the two boys' names. And so he was exactly the opposite of that. He was a shepherd, a profession that God cherishes more than any other. And he brought the finest and first fruits of his flock to Yah. Yah was really impressed and paid a lot of attention to what he did and ignored what created to be possessed brought him. And so Cain threw a tizzy fit. He just absolutely got angry. He got belligerent. He was jealous. I mean, all the worst in human behavior. And so Yahweh comment to him was just really, it was just fascinating. He said, "Hey, why are you acting this way?" And of course, Cain's response was, "Why not?" And so God said, if you had a better attitude, if you were pleasant to be around, if you were just a little more agreeable, then everything would be better for you. You'd be elevated in stature. You'd find more joy in your life. You'd be lifted up in spirit. What you need is a better attitude. I had never thought that's what God said, because it's always translated in English translations. If you're good and do good, then you'll be saved. But it doesn't say that. I said, your whole countenance, everything about you will be lifted up and raised if you just had a better attitude. If you were pleasant to be around. And I just got such a kick out of that because I've always said there's only one debilitating handicap. It's a bad attitude. Yeah, a bad attitude. You can prevail with one arm. You can prevail with two arms, with zero arms, you know, functional. You can prevail with sight and blind. You can prevail, you know, able to speak and or not, deaf or dumb.
Yeah.
You know, I've been around
like a Helen Keller.
Yeah, mentally handicapped young men and women, and I can tell you they get a lot of joy out of life. There's only one real tremendous handicap. It's not poverty. It's not ethnicity. It's not a physical impairment. It's a bad attitude. And that's what God said. It was just so delightful to hear him counter Cain's tizzy fit with, you know, this negative attitude of yours is just not going to work. And it strikes me that that really is part of Yahweh's filter. He wants people around him that are fun to be around, that going to spend eternity with him. And so he's really looking for relationships that are enjoyable. Anyway, let's jump back in the where we were, because that's way ahead of where we were. But that's part of doing this translation and commentary every day, is you stumble across things and you say, well, I can't wait to share that. Sometimes I have all the patience of of a gnat. So, there you go. If you don't like it, dock my pay. Then Yahweh Almighty formed for association and accompaniment. It's F is for association and accompaniment. Adam, out of the material substance of the ground. Ha, Adama. This is the first part of 2:7. We'll get to the second part, which I know you've done your word study on, Kirk, here in just a moment. But there are a couple of things here that are worth noting. One is that Yashar means to form, to forge, to fashion, to plan, to prepare, to devise, to shape. And so Adam's physical body was something God created. He thought about, he fashioned it, and then he forged it. We're going to see in the next statement that Adam is triune in nature. He has a physical body. He has a soul, which is his consciousness, his ability to be a living being where he can observe his environment and respond to it. That's something that all animals have. But he also has an asama, a seat of judgment, an ability to think. And so he's a triune being. And Yahweh is not going to use bara or yashar to infuse Adam with these other two attributes, just the physical body. So the physical body was formed. The other two, Yahweh breathed into Adam. And that's such an important concept that I really never paid any attention to until I got an email from J.K., who is one of our most effective editors. And J.K. said, yo, you ever think about that? That if God breathed this nephesh, and I'm getting ahead because that's the second half of the statement, but if he breathed the nephesh and the nesama into us, that they're from God. That's part of God inside of humanity. Where our physical bodies are of a material realm, something very, very, very distant from God. So I just thought that was fascinating. We should contemplate what that means, that we have a bit of God inside of us. And to some degree, that means that when we take a life, we are destroying an aspect of God. So we ought to really think about why we ought not take a life. Why God said, you should not make a habit of killing. So it's exceedingly interesting from that point of view. So first is that Adam was created. His physical body was created out of the material substance, afar. Afar is as close as Hebrew has to atom or molecule. It's the finest, smallest of all natural particles and earthen elements. So God is telling us that, you know, I created this universe, and there was this transition from light energy to matter, and that you are comprised of matter. We're comprised of stardust. That means that God is not saying that, you know, man was this being that he created. My wife loves to use the term willy-nilly, just out of nothing, just out of his imagination, something really spectacular. He says, no. You were created out of the finest, smallest particulate of the material world, molecules and atoms, just like you're going to find on the earth itself. The second aspect of that is that the ground, or the soil, the earth, is atoma. You know the difference between atom and atoma? One's masculine, the one's feminine. One's masculine, the other one's feminine. That's it. Atom and atoma, same word. You put the hay at the end of it, it makes it feminine. But atoma and atom are the same. So when God says, I created the man, ha Adam, out of the atoma, we probably want to make a connection there, that that there's a masculine and feminine nature to the world that God created, and that man came from woman, from a female, something feminine out of the ground. So that's a lot to, I think, to deduce from just the first half of Bereshit, Genesis 2:7. Then Yahweh Almighty. Now, just one last thought before we move on.
Okay.
There are very few places in the Torah, the prophets, or the Psalms where Yahweh says, I am Yahweh Almighty. He is Yahweh, or he uses either his name, Yahweh, he does that a couple of times. I think last time I counted it was 7,000 times in Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses his title. Probably an equal number of times, darn near, El or Elohim. But throughout the earliest mentions of Yahweh's name, it is always Yahweh Elohim. And I think that's just interesting because, you know, we haven't had the encounter with, in Bereshit, we haven't had the encounter with Moshe yet, where God says, you know, tell the children of Israel that my name is Yahweh. I am who I am. You know, Yahweh is the name that I choose to be called for all time. It's my one and only name. We haven't received that introduction yet. So Yahweh is saying, I'm. There is something different from the fact that my name is unique, but I just happen to be God. Then Yahweh Almighty formed, and I like. Anytime you have the opportunity to translate F, I do. Most English Bible translations ignore F unless it has to be translated. And I choose to translate it unless it has to be silent. Just a different approach. I find every letter of every word interesting. And F, it's depending on its context, it can mean with or against. It can mean in association or accord with or in opposition to. But it's the second most common Hebrew preposition, hep. So he created for the purpose of association and accompaniment, Adam, ha, Adam. And here again, we have an interesting insight in that about 90% of the references to Adam in the garden story He is called Ha Adam. That is the man as a title. So it's the man named Adam. It's kind of like Yahweh is God. Yahweh Elohim could be Yahweh Almighty or Yahweh is God. And this is Ha Adam. It's either the man or Adam or the man, Adam. Out of the material substance of the ground, of the earth. Since this is the first time that Yahweh's name is mentioned to us in the Torah, I thought that just take a moment and say that Yahweh's name is comprised of a Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh. The Yod is depicted by way of an outstretched arm and hand. It conveys the willingness, the authority, the ability to reach out and do whatever work is required to accomplish a task. Now, before we go on to the next letter, work. Work is something that has been obliterated from religion because they prefer faith, particularly in Christianity, where they prefer grace. I think it's five times in the account of Eden that Yahweh says that he created Adam. So our maker knows something about our nature where work is highly valued. The first letter in his name speaks of work, of Yahweh's name. And he is telling us if we want to be like him, we ought to work. It is so debilitating to one's sense of values and character to have everything just given to you and not work for it. Coming to this point, to translate it, so many volumes of texts of Yahweh's word, and then sharing insights and commentary to help understand it and share what we've learned from it. That's work. You know, I'll get up at 5:30 in the morning and sit down in this chair and can't wait to go back at it and see what can we learn, what can we add to, what can we improve. It's work. Work has such tremendous value, so many rewards. And the first letter in Yahweh's hand is a work-related letter. It speaks of the number one parental responsibility, which is to reach down and out with an open hand to our children, to do the work necessary to give them the greatest opportunity in life to teach them what they need to know so that they will choose to form a relationship with God, so that they use their conscience, their sense of values appropriately. They exercise good judgment. They're exposed to the world so that they can think properly. And then, of course, protecting them, building a home, feeding them, nurturing them, clothing them, all those kinds of things work. So the mission is identified in the tent peg, the ancient Hebrew wa, because it speaks of securing and enlarging a protective enclosure. Have you ever gone on a camping trip, guys, with where you took a tent peg with you?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. How effective is the tent peg if you toss it on the ground?
Very. It's relevant.
That wouldn't even make a good paperweight, would it?
No.
No.
And does
for
not.
A tent peg to be useful, you have to attach it to the tent, and you have to pound it into the ground, correct?
That's right. That's work.
So, yeah, it's work. Yeah, you got to know what you're doing with it. You got to remember to bring it, and you have to then...
And a hammer.
How to use it, and then how to deploy it. So a tent peg is work. But what the tent peg does is in an ancient home, it secures and enlarges that home. Without the tent peg, even if you had the world's biggest tent, even if you had the tallest center pole to hold it up, without the tent peg, you got nothing. It'll just hang straight down on that tent peg. It could be really tall, but you're not getting inside. and the first wind that blows, it would be gone. So the tent peg adds to the size, adds to the livability, adds to the security of a home. Initially, this sheltered living place and home, represented by that tent peg, was the protective garden of Eden. Gan means to enclose and to protect, creating an environment that's suitable to life. That's what Gan means. So the tent peg originally represented Eden. And in the end, it represents Sukkah, which is tabernacles, it's shelters, it's camping out with God. So that tent peg anchors the word of Yah in the beginning and the end. When Yahweh says, I am the beginning, I am the end, he is saying this very thing, that we begin in Eden, we conclude in Sukkah, and in both, he created a secure and enlarged home for his children. So it depicts the time that we're afforded the opportunity to camp out with God. Now, on either side of that tent peg, we find two hays in Yahweh's name. And it is through them that we discover the beneficiaries of Yahweh's work, men and women, who look to their Heavenly Father and spiritual mother for guidance and assistance. The Hebrew hey is the most complex letter. It shows a man and or a woman, depending on where it's positioned within a word or a name, both arms raised, pointing up to the heavens. In fact, it's interesting. There are five terms and conditions of the covenant. There's five benefits of the covenant. There are five hands in Yahweh's name. I was once thought that there may be the possibility that the two people in Yahweh's name were Adam and Chawa. But thinking that for the most part, those two people are Abraham and Sarah. And I do think that it is more likely that the male and female in Yahweh's name represent Abraham and Sarah. But there is, you know, the possibility that it's also the first family with Adam and Jawa. But it's a little hard to choose them because, well, we all have our failings, and God can overlook our failings. The story of Adam and Chawa is not the story of two individuals who had their act together. You know, there's this problem where Chawa misquotes Yahweh, adds to what Yahweh's testimony is, entertains the misquotation of Satan, and then is enticed with the idea of, if I eat that, I'm going to be a rival to God. And Adam not only ate it without saying, you know, wait a minute, Shavuot, we ought not be doing this. It was the instruction was given to us in the imperfect, which means you're still okay if you just stop. And I'll be okay if I don't get started here. So we got a really good thing going here. Let's not blow it. But he didn't. He not only ate, but then when Yahweh said, hey, Adam, what are you doing here? You know, why are you hiding from me? Did you do something I told you, you know, wasn't going to work out real well for you? And he said, the woman. The woman that you gave me, she gave it to me. Must be your fault. You gave me that woman. She is effective. You take her back. No, he didn't say you take her. The woman you gave me, he was not willing to take responsibility. And that's not a good thing. If we're going to resolve our relationship issues with God, take responsibility. That's an important first step in the whole process. You know, Like, you want to have a relationship with God, the first thing you got to do is choose to walk away from religion and politics and conspiracy and all that sort of thing before you can even begin the process. You got to take responsibility for your own choices. Okay. There, it's next that we're going to discover some words that you did some research on. Nafak, which is blue or breath, into Adam's aph, nostrils, a chayim, life-giving, restoring, and sustaining, even renewing and prolonging, nesama, conscience, which facilitates our ability to think rationally and exercise good judgment, providing us with the unique human capability to discern between right and wrong, truth and deception. Therefore, the nesama is something unique, something associated with chayim, lives, which is a plural throughout the creation account. So this is the second half of Bereshit, Genesis 2:7. He blew. Yahweh blew. Nefak, breathed. Into his nostrils, Ba'af-Hu, into his nose, his breathing passageway, a life-giving, restoring, and sustaining chayim, lives. The plural of che, reviving, renewing, and prolonging. Conscience, nesama, seat of rational thinking and good judgment, of recognizing the difference between right and wrong. And Adam came to exist as a living soul. Haya, che, la nefesh. So the soul represents one of three components of Adam's nature. Man is a material being with a conscience and consciousness. So, Kirk, you did some analysis here. I received a sheet from you today on the second half of Bereshit 2:7, and you started with Nafak.
Yes.
What'd you learn?
Recently, I was starting just to do nesama, and then I wanted to say about the breath. And I was curious at what kind of breath is this, or whether it had any clue to how significant it was. And you look through the lexicons, of course, and you have to breathe or to blow, to exhale, to give out breath. And then you look at the root, and I seem to do that all the time now. The root is a pay and a chet, and also means to attach or to join, which is an odd thing to think about, breath. And then when you break down the whole word with the three letters, you have a nun, which is very interesting. If you look at the nun and analyze it, you've got a 50 as a number. 50 is a very significant number to us because that's a Yobel year. It is when everyone is forgiven. So it's a freedom and reconciliation. It applies all of those things for the heirs. And then it's also, it is the way we produce the, it is a sperm, the way we produce, symbolic of the heirs, the sons and the daughters. So it's an ongoing thing. And all this is starting out with nefak, just breath. Then the pay is an 80. Divisible by 8. It's a mouth to speak. It's a breath in life. It means to communicate, thus a relationship. What's the point if you can't, you only have a relationship with people that you can communicate with some way. It doesn't have to be by voice, but you can use hand signals, but you have to have that. So it's not an ordinary grunting Neanderthal, as I would say, that he was creating here. He wants to have someone who can think and respond. So, and this, of course, it means language as well. So, and that was one of the first gifts he gave us, besides our ability. Well, we have language and we have life and we have choice and all that sort of thing. And then we have Chet. Chet is also the number 8. So once again, it's eternal, and it's also a fence. So it's an eternal protection. It separates us from outside influences, from things that can harm us, or it keeps us safe. It's the walls of the family home every time you see that. So that led me up to, so now he's breathed into Adam, and she used his breath, and the result is an nesama. And I was just looking at the psalm after I wrote down the things that you normally would expect to find there. And then the psalm is the breath of a man or God. It's the essence of life. It's breath, a blast, a spirit, an inspiration, and a soul. The thing that differentiates a human being, though, without in the psalm, is that it has an ability to discern the difference between right and wrong. Thus, it is conscious and rational thinking. But then as I was looking at it, right in the middle of it is Shammah. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I looked at Shammah. And first I was going to dismiss this because Shammah, to hear, is with a A, and this is A-H. However, if you think about the A and the A-H, they are both, the A means to observe, and the A is also an observant person. So that presented no block to me as far as looking at it, is the word to listen is in there.
Yeah, so it's pretty hard to miss the Shammah and Shamar relationship.
Well, I'm looking at it in English.
Neshama is essentially the nun, which is not only sowing the seeds of future growth, but also a sperm, and that it represents new life, a child being born. So as a child being born who is observant, a child being born who listens, and that listening and being observant are the essence of what Nesama means, because it doesn't do you any good to exercise good judgment unless you have listened and observed and you have access to good information. So Nesama is a human computer in the sense, except unlike an artificial life form or a computer, it has no conscience, no ability to make judgments, but only can do calculations. The human Nesama is the seat of judgment, of morality, of right and wrong. And so what you have to have to exercise it is that machine, that human machine, must have access to quality information. And the two things God asks us to do with his testimony is to listen and observe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a blend of those two.
Yeah. So that's basically what I did. I took the nun, and when you put a nun in front of a word, on my little grammar chart, it says that emphasizes or intensifies the action of the verb. So we're talking some serious stuff here. When you take the Shammah word itself with the shin, mem, and ain, and it means you go through all your lexicons and you'll find this means to hear, to perceive, or to apprehend by ear, to listen attentively. So then I broke that down a little bit more because you have some other words spelled the same way. So I threw those in the mix. We have Shema, which is spelled exactly the same way, which means to report an account or a statement of events. So that's a response to others, perhaps, if you learn something. And also another one spelled exactly the same way is a careful hearing of someone or something, as well as responding appropriately in obedience or action. Now, that threw me, I said, because we don't have obey in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. So if you really think this through, that is an English lexicon, throwing that in, so to support their theory of Lord and Master and so forth and so on. So, but the difference between the response and obeying is the same, I said, as a carrot and a stick. A response is made from free will, from choice. If you Yahweh asked the question, he asks you to respond appropriately. HaSatan, being a Lord, demands it. So, and then I went on to say that the ability to open one's mind is a hearing is vital. Shammah is vital to understand. How do you understand? If you're not going to hear things and understand them and analyze them, as we do, as everyone that participates in this does, how could you make a judgment call on it? You have to really seriously listen, because you have and take that information, as you said just a moment ago, and then and output after you have all that input. So there's a two-letter root, which I always seem to add now, because I'm finding this there is some serious connection there. And the two-letter root in Hebrew for Shammah is Mem Shin, or I'm sorry, shin mem, backwards,
mm-hmm.
to breathe, and it can even be desolate. But the definition is that word, that two-letter word, is the wind or the breath or someone or something. It means it's something in, is its character. So he's breathed something into his character that you will not find in the ordinary upright man or men or mankind that lived on the earth at that time. So then I do something that I always do, and I nafak and neshama and neshama, and on the neshama, everything about it is, well, let's do the first word first, and then I'll turn
okay.
your show back over to you.
Okay,
the nun is the number 50. His notes from the beginning is say freedom, reconciliation, and heirs. We did that a minute ago, and the pay, mm-hmm. and then the chet. The pay is the 80 and 8. We covered that. But Nisama is also pretty good. It has the nun, which is the continuance of a generation, the heirs, and those who choose Yahweh. And they choose freedom because it is the number 50, and to be set free. The shin is teeth, nourishment, pressure. And there will be pressure to make a decision, too, coming up. It's the gifts of language, and it's the number 300. And every time I see the number 300, I always flash back on the story of Gideon, where it says, by the 300 will I save, or will I set free.
Mm-hmm.
Amen. It's the waves of water. Life emanates from the sea, if you like, cleansing, mighty power. It can be blood, even chaos of the sea, or like the sea of Gentiles. In this case, it's all positive. And it is the number 40. 140 is reconciliation periods. You went through the 40 years in the desert to start again, restart button. And then the hay is a person looking up at an awesome sight to reveal upright and engaged.
Mm-hmm.
Not kneeling, by the way, walking the path. The breath one experiences, with breath one experiences life to the fullest. So you have, and it's the number 5. And of course, every time you see the number 5, the most obvious thing that you even alluded to a minute ago is the covenant, 5 terms and conditions of the covenant. That's a lot for a conscious.
Mm-hmm.
but it's very telling.
It should be a lot. It's
so much.
Yeah,
it should.
Yeah.
So
this is the foundational word.
Yes.
And it's not only just a foundational word, it's given to us very early on in the story, because without exercising it, none of the rest of the story is going to make sense.
Yeah.
You need this word.
Mm-hmm. And if it's, as you were saying, it's a part of God putting into it. He's putting your character into you.
Right.
You can do it. You can change your character. You can not respond. You can respond poorly. You can respond to something else, as Yahweh chose to do. But he put that in them with his breath. So
right.
So
it's a tool.
It's
a tool that helped us become born anew, if you will, the nun, through the words of God, the SH, the shin, to be
mm-hmm.
cleansed and to experience new life, which is the waters of mm-hmm. mem, on behalf of those who stand up, look up, and who are observing.
Walk too.
Walking, walking with Yah.
Those legs are apart.
The nature of this word. Now,
The
word itself, is defined for us in the book of Job. And the book of Job is such an interesting story because it is the story of a man who had a great relationship with Yah. And we're told this story. Sometimes people say, why would God allow Hasatan to torment this guy such that, he was having this wonderful life and, got everything taken away from him just because we wanted to see how he's going to react. And I was asked that question a couple of days ago. I said, so that we would have to have it happen to us? I will tell you that you take enough away from somebody, they're all going to all going to turn. There's a point that we all lose it. And so Yahweh was saying, don't be so full of yourself that you're cocky and say, I can do anything. Look at Dode had the best relationship in the history of humankind with Yahweh. And, it got so bad at one point that he went over to the crazy old Philistines. you know, and said, I can't handle it anymore.
Like a crazy man.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Act like a crazy man. There's only so much that we can take, and we ought not be too full of ourselves, and we just ought to recognize that that's the possibility. I mean, you can't have it better than Adam had it. You know, and dude did some really stupid stuff. And said some stupid stuff. So, you know, Sarah had it pretty good, too, and she laughed right in God's face. You know, Abraham had a pretty good life, and Yah tried to offer him the covenant. He says, you know, what the heck do I want with an inheritance? Well, what good is an inheritance going to do me? You know, I'm an old dude, don't even have any kids. You know, so we ought not be too full of ourselves, is sort of the message there. So here's how the Sama is explained in the book of Job, which means Yah's land. Truthfully and verifiably, akin. Well, that's a good word to start with, right? Indeed, emphasizing this point, surely and truly. The spirit, she, in mortal man, Enosh, in humankind, and the Nesama, conscience, of the Almighty, teaches them so that they can make the proper connections and come to understand. Bien. Now, did you catch that?
Yes, I did.
The spirit, she, and mortal man. So if you're going to learn, you need to have the spirit working with you. But the next part of it, the Nesama, conscience of the Almighty. In other words, J.K. was right. The Nesama is on loan from God.
Yeah.
It's part of God in us. And since it's part of God in us, we really ought to exercise it. We ought to value it, prize it, take advantage of it. There's a reason that socialist secular humanism, liberalism, if you will, and humankind is so insistent on political correctness, where you do not exercise good judgment. Where you're told to accept that which isn't true because it's politically correct. That you're told not to be judgmental. You're told not to be discriminating. You're told not to be discerning. But to go along. To accept mutually exclusive concepts as all being true. And so it is what man wants to drum out of man. Is this gift of God. The Nesama. So, truthfully and verifiably, the spirit, she, Ed, mortal man, and the Nesama of the Almighty teaches them so that they can make the proper conclusions and come to understand. This ability to make connections between things, to be discerning, to be discriminating, is the result of the spirit helping us understand the words that God conveyed so that we exercise our God-given Nesama such that we grow to embrace, enjoy the single most valuable thing in the universe. The single most valuable thing in the universe. It's not eternal life. It's not salvation. It's not even the Word of God. Understanding. If you understand the Word of God, if you understand life, if you understand the choices that are before us, if you understand what God is offering and what He expects in return, if you understand Yahweh's name, if you understand the relationship that He has with the chosen people, if you understand the purpose of the Torah, if you understand the purpose of the covenant, if you understand the conditions of the covenant, you understand the benefits of the covenant, you understand the purpose and the benefits of the seven invitations to meet with God. If you understand the nature of the Spirit, if you understand the God-given gift of a conscience, of a Nesama, then there's nothing that can prevail against you. single most valuable thing in the universe is understanding. And that is what God gives us through the Spirit in the Nesama. So if you want to know what Nesama is, it's that part of God's nature within man that we can exercise so that we make the proper connections to understand. And there's nothing we can't achieve when we understand. So under that basis, it's amazing that there isn't a single English Bible translation that renders Nesama as conscience. Not one. It's the breath of life. Well, Nesama doesn't mean breath. Nefak, you've already analyzed the word. It means breath.
Yeah.
Nefesh can also mean breath. But Nesama doesn't mean breath. You know, Nefesh doesn't mean life. It's consciousness. It means soul. God chose these words. The least we could do is to translate them accurately. And so it is incumbent upon us to render He blew, wa nefak, into his nostrils, ba a hu, a life-giving, restoring, and sustaining, chayim, conscience, nesama, seat of rational judgment, discernment, discrimination. And Adam, the man, came to exist as a living soul, nefesh. Chay nefesh, in fact, haya chay nefesh. Powerful when we just simply take the time to understand. Now, based upon this, we can confidently conclude that an Nesama has been placed within mortal man to work in concert with the set-apart spirit. When in sync, our conscience, therefore, makes it possible for the Spirit of God to impart instructions such that we can learn through her teaching and comprehend the truth. As a result of her input, and by using Yahweh's Nesama, we can make informed connections in a discerning and discriminating manner, and then make that transition from knowing to understanding. You know, in Yeshaya 11, that speaks of the choder, which is the insignificant stem, and the neck, which is this sign that Yahweh is going to lift up to call his people home. God goes out of his way to explain, this is the reason that this individual is going to be effective as they ascribe this neck. It's my spirit and the spirit of understanding that is enabling this process. Now that is what God is saying here. So while God's Nesama does not make us wise, certainly as wise as God, it makes it possible for us to know God. And while his Nesama does not make us immortal, it provides the ability to understand and rely upon the source of eternal existence. It is that aspect of our design nature that unites us with the source of life. And I think it's interesting in this regard that Nesama is based on Nasham, meaning the process of childbirth. Our nefesh, or soul, makes us conscience, similar to all other animals. Yahweh's Nesama, however, makes us like God, providing us with the ability to distinguish between right and wrong. It is this human element that seeks to yada Yahweh. That said, let's. What I want to do is to continue with this presentation. It says that Yahweh Almighty planted and established. This is 2:8. This is the next thing that God says. So you understand. We humans have a triune nature. We have a physical body. We have a a soul, which is our consciousness, and we have a nefesh conscience. So he just said, that's the stuff of humanity. One I created from the elements of the earth. The other two I shared with you. I gave from me to you. Yahweh Almighty planted and established a home to celebrate life. Nata. As a gone protected garden of Eden, great pleasure and joy, pursuant to a time long ago. So again, Yahweh identified himself as God, planted. He established a home to celebrate life, not I. Embedded the seeds for growth as a dwelling place. Now, God's consistent. If he created this garden, planted it, established it, embedded these seeds of growth, you can be assured he's going to do it again. Just because we've uprooted most everything good, God's going to do it again. As a gan. Gan is a shielded and surrounded enclosure with a protective fence. It is from ganan to defend, to shelter, to create something that is suitable for sustaining life. Of Eden, a favorable circumstance, which is tremendously delightful, ultimately pleasurable, and extremely satisfying. It is from Adan, luxurious and delightful. God's night, you go camping with God, you're not going to stay in the Motel 6. You are not going to be in a dive. All right? God does stuff with glass. You're going to go camp out with God. You're going to have a really cool tent. It's going to be in a beautiful spot with a magnificent view. Guaranteed. Waterfalls, flora, fauna, perfect weather condition. And your tent, you ain't going to be sleeping on rocky ground and wake up with a headache. All right? As a matter of fact, I am pretty darn sure not going to be any mosquitoes. It's
wow,
going to be cool. Yeah, it's going to be cool. You know, God travels first class. He created a beautiful garden that was perfect for life, and he called it first class. He called it luxurious. He called it delightful. He called it ultimately pleasurable. So, you know, all these religious people that are denying pleasures. You know, they'll beat themselves, they'll whip themselves, they'll turn themselves into suicide bombs. They'll deny themselves the enjoyments of sensuality and affection. Well, God says, no, you got that all wrong. My idea of a good time is it's going to be pleasurable. It's going to be joyous. It's going to be happy. It's going to be luxurious. And this was pursuant to a time long ago. Then he placed Adam there, whom for the benefit of the relationship and to show the way, Asher, he had fashioned and formed. Well, guess what? That means that man was conceived outside of the garden.
Yes.
That would mean
I'll ask you about that.
That humankind was one of the things that animals God created, and he made this one individual unique by breathing into him the Nesama. Then he created this beautiful environment for him and said, hey, come on inside. I'm going to place you inside a perfect environment so we can enjoy being together. So there's a lot to learn there. You know, God was not inside the garden creating Adam. No, man was created outside the garden. Men and women existed outside the garden. You know, that means when God marshaled in all the animals for for Adam to have the opportunity to interact with and to meet and ultimately name. Guess mm-hmm. what? A couple of those animals, men and women.
Oh, I had not thought of that.
Yep, men and women.
Wow. Wow.
Yep. And so God was really showing him all these animals and saying, oh, is there something here? And he didn't say the whole thing was to simply to name. He wanted to see how Adam would respond to them. And so part of it said, okay, I'll bring out another dude here. It doesn't have the Nisama. But, you know, maybe that'll keep Adam entertained. You know, something for him to spend the time that we're not together. And then I'll even bring out a pretty. I'll bring out a woman, not with an Nisama. And so what's the term they use? A sapiosexual, I think, is the term. Someone whose interest in the opposite sex is not so much based upon their physical attributes, but instead their mental acuity is a sapiosexual. So perhaps Adam was a sapiosexual because when the men and women were paraded before him, it did without an Asama. He was not impressed. Although when Chawa was made from him and therefore had an Asama, he was the speech that he gives on her is a wow. God, this is the ultimate gift. So here is Yahweh Almighty. He planted and established this garden home to celebrate life, and he called the place luxurious, pleasurable, extremely satisfying. And he placed Adam there, whom, for the benefit of the relationship and to show the way, he had fashioned and formed. I'm sorry, I just woke up my dog. For those that don't know, my dog's name is Asher. She's down here at my feet listening to the show, wondering why I'm calling her name.
Did he cave? Let me ask you a quick question before you go.
Uh-huh.
Did he cave to her with the fruit because he was maybe he was intimidated by her intellect?
The story on the fruit and the nature of it is one we're going to get to in the next two chapters, and it is so interesting as to God said. Yeah, I will say one thing that is really interesting about it is that, and we're going to analyze every possible motivation that Chawa had. And then we're going to analyze Adam's motivations. We're going to even analyze Satan's motivations. We're going to analyze Satan's tactics. And we're going to learn a lot. I will guarantee you that. But one of the things that I want to be really careful of here is there's this inference that God said to do not eat from this tree, or that God gave them a commandment, do not eat from this tree. Mm-hmm. Don't you dare eat from that tree. It's even called the prohibited fruit. God didn't tell him to eat from the tree. Nope. Yeah. He just said, this garden, it's got all this wonderful stuff in it. You can do whatever you want. But there is a tree here that should you eat from it, then you're going to come to represent what it entails, and you're going to die. So all he said is that you can eat anything you want. If this tree, if you eat of it, however, there's a consequence. Not a very good consequence. So he didn't tell him you can't eat from it. Didn't order him or commandment, nothing like that. Just said, over here, that choice will come with a consequence. And he even wrote it in the imperfect, which gave Adam and Chawa a lot of latitude.
Well, yeah.
It means that Chawa and Adam a lot of latitude so that you can. One and done was not going to be enough. Okay, so what I want to do is, and this might sound crazy, we're right in the middle of the creation story, and I'm going to go into Yashayah. But the reason I'm going to go into Yashayah, and I might be crazy, could be certifiable, but fortunately, this kind of crazy is the kind of crazy that Yahweh will like, so it's all cool. The reason I want to go into Yashayah is that there is a chapter of Yashayah where God explains the single most relevant aspect of Eden. And the single most relevant aspect of Eden is pay really close attention to it, because that's where we're going. So many people think that's what man was, and then he had the fall, and we're dealing with the fall of man. Well, no, we're not. So little of the story of Adam and Chawa in Eden is there for us to have this historical perspective of the fall of man. It isn't there for that reason. It's there because God wanted to explain why he created man, what makes man unique, what was important in a relationship between men and women, and what God enjoys, therefore what he is offering and seeking in return, because this is where we're headed. And what the prophet Yashayah explains is that we're headed right back to Eden. This whole journey we're on is from Eden to Eden. We're coming full circle. The reason that Sukkah, camping out, is the seventh and last of the feasts each year is because it is the destination. We're headed right back to where we were. If you like what happened in Eden, you're going to like eternity. If you don't, you won't. So God is revealing to us what he's offering and what he enjoys and what we're going to be doing by telling us this story. So that's why we're going to Yashayah. Besides that, I like Yashayah. I really do. I like Yashayah.
Really?
I just love Yashayah. At first, I used to really dislike Yashayah because his vocabulary was so different than everybody else. So you work on this skill of craft, this art of translating these Hebrew words to elicit the greatest amount of meaning and to deduce insights that you can share and to help people, you know, you become a student so that you can teach. And you apply this this craft, this skill, and you develop it, you hone it. And then you come to Yashayah, and it's all for naught. Because dude's vocabulary is so far. Oh, you got to look them all up again. It's a much more sophisticated palate that he has. And it's one of the beauties of Yah's prophets is that Yah speaks through these men, so he's not using them as a dictating machine. He's enabling them to convey in their own words what they're hearing Yahweh say. So you get it flavored through these unique individuals. And this guy I liked because he's the guy, if you're going to devote yourself to trying to share what Yahweh is conveying through his prophets, you realize you're not going to be popular. You're not going to have a following. If having a following, making lots of money, and being popular are your thing, giving lots of accolades, don't do this, because it isn't going to happen. Because there was none better at this than Yashayah. It was the best. And yet, do you know how many people Yashayah had in his entire life that actually benefited from what he conveyed?
And yet, zero.
Zero.
Unfortunately, zero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not one. And so you develop this sense of comfort of saying, all right, he was the best there ever was, and he was directly inspired by Yah. And what we're doing is analyzing what Yahweh said through them and trying to convey it to the best of our ability. Why should we expect that we're going to get better results than Yahshua did? Well, fortunately, we are going to get better results than Yahshua did. And Yahshua tells us the reason why is that Yahweh was required to make his people such that they were blind and deaf to the prophets, because if he hadn't done that, what rabbinic Judaism would have created is a religion that was so effective at being bad, it would have been nigh on impossible for us to figure this out and to differentiate Yahweh's word from the religious. What if rabbinic Jews actually used Yahweh's name? You know how much harder it would be to disprove what they had to say? What if rabbinic Judaism was actually based on the Torah as opposed to the Talmud?
Yeah.
It'd be so much more difficult to differentiate the truth from the lie. So he dumbed them down so they couldn't do that. And so we are now in a position where Yahweh is calling his people home. He's opening up their eyes and their ears so that they can listen to the words that he inspired through Yahshua and through Dod. And so all we are is a conduit for their message. It's a time now that it's resonating. So, choose to listen to me. Those of you who are genuinely pursuing vindication by being correct. Those seeking to learn about and know Yahweh should choose to be observant so as to develop the proper respect and respond appropriately to the godly rock you were hewn, set apart from, and engraved, as well as to the excavation of the cistern from which you were removed. So that's Yahshua 51:1. So if you're not like me and you don't have a love affair with Yahshua Isaiah, which I do, yeah, you'd still have to say, well, that's a pretty good opening line. Choose to listen to Yahweh. Those of you who are genuinely pursuing vindication by being correct. If you want to be Tzedak, right?
Right.
Listen to Yahweh. So if you want to be right, he is saying, you know, don't pick up your favorite book from Stephen Hawking. Don't go and pick up a book from Darwin. Don't go pick up a book from Karl Marx. Listen to Yahweh. Shama Elani. Listen to me. Those of you who are generally pursuing vindication by being correct. Those seeking to learn and know Bakash. Those securing, or those searching by using due diligence to acquire information. Yahweh should choose to be observant so as to develop the proper respect and respond appropriately. And then God uses some interesting metaphors. To the godly rock, sure, which is the crag at the summit. He's speaking, of course, of Mount Horeb, where the Torah was revealed. From which you were set apart from and engraved. God is saying, I literally wrote upon you, engraved this message to you on that rock. As well as to the excavation of the cistern from which you were removed. What's the purpose of a cistern? What does a cistern hold?
It's collect water.
Water, yeah. Drinking water. The source of life and purification from which you were removed. Now, you could also say cistern because he's saying, you know, have some respect for this pit from which you were removed before. Yeah. What's the pit? Sheol. We have been removed from Sheol based upon a respect and the teaching we have discern from Yahweh. Yahshayah 51:1. Then he says, choose to be observant so that you can properly interpret and understand by looking to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah, who God has labored for such a long time expecting you. For indeed, he is the one when I invited him to meet with me so that I could kneel down to lift him up and bless him. Then I tremendously enriched and empowered him, making him far greater than he had been. Now, that happened, what, 1968 BCE? Mm-hmm. This is 700 BCE. And so Yahweh is speaking in first person through Yahshayah and said, okay, you want to understand? You want to be right about me? You generally want to find me? You want to understand me? You want to develop this relationship with me? You want to do that? Well, let me tell you how you do that. Choose to be observant so that you can properly interpret and understand by looking to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah. Well, why would we look to Abraham and Sarah? What did they do?
Terms of the conditions of the covenant.
Absolutely. Every term and condition of the covenant, all benefits of the covenant are revealed through those two individuals. You want to understand how to establish a relationship with God, you must turn to the covenant.
Go there.
If you don't understand the covenant relationship that Yahweh established with Abraham and Sarah, you cannot understand God. You don't understand his purpose. You'll never know him. You'll never spend eternity with him.
Can't agree to something you don't know. You got to study.
And so God is directing our attention to where our attention should be directed. It's the covenant. You know, I'm about ready to start presenting the terms and conditions of the covenant for volume 2 of Yad Yad. And I'm right there, I'm admitting this, as you know, this is not the first time you're going to see these. I'm going to present the terms and conditions of the covenant, not only in volume 2 of Yad Yad, but in an introduction to God. Same exact terms and conditions, same exact source material we're deriving it from, same exact translation, same conclusions. But it's the pivotal chapter of an introduction to God. And guess what? It's going to be presented all over again in its entirety in Observations for Our Time.
Why not?
Going to present it over and over and over again.
That's how you learn it.
What does Yahweh say? If you want to, you're genuinely searching for him, then you ought to be observant so that you can properly interpret and understand by looking to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah, who has labored for a long time expecting you. Yeah, Abraham figured it out. By inheritance, what God's doing through me is this covenant, and all of you who are embracing the same terms and conditions that I do, I'm expecting you. For indeed, he was just one when I invited him to meet with me. You think he's one now?
No.
Well, of course not. So many covenant members now.
Mm-hmm.
He was just one when I invited him to meet with me. And even that is telling, because most people aren't aware that the vast majority of people, if not 100% of them, that form a relationship with Yahweh, were invited to do so. As I said, I had lunch today with a gentleman who refers to himself as anti-religious, but he's quite political. And there is no chance that he's going to be able to process what I'm saying if he doesn't give up his affinity for religion, or excuse me, for politics. If he doesn't give it up, it ain't going to happen. Right. God's not interested in him until he's walks away from those things. And so God introduces himself to those he wants to develop a relationship with. And there's lots of ways he can do that. He can introduce himself through a direct, hello, my name is Yahweh. I want you to do something for me. He did that with Abraham. He did that with Moshe.
Mm-hmm.
He told Shamuel to go and pursue. Yeshe's sons until he said, "That's the one I want." So God does the choosing, and we can choose to ignore him. We can choose to oppose him. We can choose to respond. But if we choose to respond, then God is saying, if you really want to understand, you better focus on Abraham and Sarah, that relationship. For indeed, he was one when I invited him to meet with me. So that, and that's Kara, by the way, that I could kneel down to lift him up and bless him. This is Barak. That is what Yahweh does to covenant members. He, just like a father would get down on a knee to lift up a child, Yahweh is saying with the covenant members that he gets down on his knee to lift us up. Then I tremendously enriched and empowered him and made him far greater than he had been. Rabbahu. That's the benefit of the covenant. We're enriched. We're empowered. Yeshayah 51:2. Even if Yeshayah didn't cover our return to Eden, it'd be worth translating it just for the first two statements, would it not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, of course.
That is so exceedingly important that here this statement in Yahweh speaking in first person, and he says, okay, you want to understand? Be observant. And you really want to get it, then turn your attention to, focus on, seek to understand and appreciate the nature of Abraham and Sarah and what they represent and what I did for them. Indeed, Yahweh will comfort and console Zion. He will be demonstrating compassion for her destroyed and depopulated places, and even her lifeless places where the word is questioned, he will cause to be like Eden, great pleasure and joy. And also, her land that Arabs have deforested and depopulated will be as the Gan, the protective garden of Yahweh. Well, that's why we turn to this. So, after God says, you want to know me? You want to find the truth? Be observant. Listen. You really want to understand? Focus on understanding the relationship that I formed with Abraham and Sarah and how I enriched and empowered them and I blessed their lives. Then he turns to us right now. And he says, indeed, I will comfort and console Zion, the signposts along the way. That's the heart of Moriah, of Jerusalem, of Yehuda, of Israel. Just as Yahweh did all of these wonderful things for Abraham and Sarah, he says, I understand this is a tough time. I'm going to comfort Zion.
He will be demonstrating compassion for all of her destroyed and depopulated places, and even her lifeless places where the word is questioned. He will cause to be like Eden. Joy. So you want to know what God's going to do when he returns? He's going to take all of the stuff that man corrupted and polluted and destroyed. He's going to take all of the terrorism and the armies and the weapons and the religious gunk and the political toxins. He's going to replace it all. He's going to turn the world back into Eden. How do we know? That's what he just said.
Huh. You don't lie.
And he's doing it on behalf of Zion. He's saying, I understand that I made a promise to Abraham. And I'm going to honor that promise. As bad as this looks now for Zion, understand, I'm going to show compassion. I'm going to console Zion. And all of her destroyed and depopulated places, I'm going to turn them into the conditions that were experienced in the great pleasure and joy. And also, Araba, her land, her deforested and depopulated places, her noxious swarms of foreigners who join in as a result of brokering a deal with the desert-dwelling Arabs. Boy, there's been a fair amount of that, hasn't there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, mm-hmm. People dealing with those desert-dwelling Arabs and all that they have destroyed. Said, I'm going to make it like Ka. It's going to be as the gods. The protected garden of Yahweh. So we can be assured that this is spoken to of what Arabs in particular are doing to depopulate Israel. And that God is going to turn all that they corrupt into Eden. It does strongly infer that Eden at this point is not going to be coterminous with eastern Turkey and Lake Van. And that at this point, Eden will be coterminous with the ridgeline of Moriah, right in the heart of Jerusalem. Overwhelming happiness and joy will be found and experienced in her. Songs of thanksgiving and the sound of singing with the accompaniment of musical instruments. Sorrow and mourning for the dead will disappear. What a wonderful transition. By going back to Eden, we will experience overwhelming happiness, exultation, gladness, jubilation. God loves to party. It's going to be joy in our footsteps. It's just like, you know, when we began the show talking about Cain, and God said, "No, why are you reacting this way? If you just have an agreeable, positive attitude, it would all work out well for you.
Might hang out with you.
Yeah. Just don't be so miserable." He's taking us back to genuine happiness. And if you want to be a curmudgeon, goodbye. This is going to be a happy, uplifting place. By the way, last week we were just cut off instantly when we hit the hour and a half mark. May happen again. If we do, we'll be with you next week. And if not, we will continue. And you know what I think? My direct connect line just blanked out. So we, in fact, may be over now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think it may be. Yeah, it says, but anyway, it's saying that I'm hearing us, so we haven't been cut off with a goodbye. So we'll just continue on this passage and then continue from it next week.
Okay.
Sorrow and anguish and mourning for death will disappear at a time that there will be no death or dying, no armies marching and killing. You know, that's what man has become exceedingly good at, is killing. No more. And can you imagine how wonderful it's going to be to be there and listen to the great lyricist of God, the singer of Yisrael, play and sing? I mean, when I was a younger man, I actually got to go to a Frank Sinatra concert. Yeah, he was pretty old at the time, but nonetheless, it was magic to be there to Frank Sinatra concerts. And I know that most of you would say, "Oh, who in the heck is Frank Sinatra?" There, you're familiar with
hardly
with other bands, and I've gone to other concerts, and you know, some that I really enjoyed. Like I happen to like the lyrics of the songs of Neil Diamond. I've been to a couple of his concerts.
Yeah.
I've been to concerts of John Denver, for example, where I really like the music and the lyrics that he wrote. America, the same thing. And going to a concert is a wonderful experience. But there's an entirely different situation. Going to a conference, now you're not in this crowded, yelling auditorium with speakers that are just blaring your ears out, with a band that's way down there and probably too drugged out to know what they're doing. You're going to be sitting next to God somewhere with this magnificent view of the universe and listening to his son sing to him and to all of us. Now, talk about a concert. And we all have a first row seat. I mean, it is just the ultimate thing to experience. And God says that's what we're going to experience. You know, God says, I'm bringing Dode back. He's going to bring Dode back as the King of Kings. He's bringing Dode back to shepherd his people. He's bringing Dode back as the return of the Messiah. But here, the suggestion is that he's bringing Dode back to sing and entertain
us. Songs. Yeah.
Yeah. Marvelous. Who's going to be worried about the dead when we're listening to Dode sing such a magnificent song? So, probably a good place for us to pause. We're going to return to Yeshaya 51:4 when we begin next week. That is, unless Kirk decides to analyze every word. And 51:3, at which point we will grow and benefit from
sorry.
From that.
Great fun for me.
I like the
as long as we're learning.
Yeah, that's right. So we're learning, and it's always important for us to recognize that God wrote
get to
this
the truth. Yeah.
So that every letter and every part of every letter would resonate with us. That the closer we look, the more we're going to understand. It's a huge part of what we do to try to understand the words that God conveyed to us. So thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to be with
pleasure,
you. Today. Yeah, it's a just what
always
a thrill it is to be able to do this and to be part of something this wonderful, where we not only come to know God, but get to work with him on what is his most important mission, which is to call his people home so that he can choose to camp out with them and we can all be part of that covenant family as were Abraham and Sarah so many years ago. Good night, and may Yah bless. Good night, y'all.
Shalom, y'all.
Shalom.